Welcome to Woolful, a podcast for fiber folk. I'm excited to share with you some incredible people I've had the opportunity to talk to in this community we love so much. From shearers and shepherds to knitters and shop owners, here's where you get to listen to a little part of their fiber journey. I want to thank our sponsors for this week's episode. Old Homestead Alpacas is a beautiful homestead built in the 1870s, located in Walla Walla, Washington, and now owned and operated by Elaine Vandiver and her husband. They're creating a wonderful and welcoming place with visions to live off the land and share their goods with their local community and beyond, including their gorgeous alpaca fiber and yarn. But their dreams go much deeper, and their story even deeper still. Elaine is an Iraq war vet, and her husband a soldier in the National Guard, and as members of the Farmer Veterans Coalition, they are hopeful that this year they will be able to partner with their local VA hospital to start a program to bring returning combat vets suffering from PTSD and other service-related trauma to the farm, sharing with them the incredible opportunity and purpose a career in farming can bring, something they themselves have found to be positively life-changing. I encourage you to visit Old Homestead Alpacas on Facebook at facebook.com/oldhomesteadalpacas and on Instagram at Old Homestead Alpacas and their lovely shop full of alpaca fiber and yarn at etsy.com/shop/oldhomesteadalpacas. Six Bits Storybooks is a digital quarterly publication for knitters who love to immerse themselves deeply in their knitting experience from the mouths of storytellers, knitters, photographers, writers, designers, friends, and nature. These storybooks incorporate designs, imagery, location, words, learning, and tools to create a deeply engaging experience, taking readers on a journey. Six Bits was created by two incredibly passionate and inspiring folks within this community, Melissa and Melody, and this week they're releasing their second issue, Dwell, a beautiful digital editorial magazine featuring articles from international knitters and dyers, where you hear the whole story behind the designs and modeled in beautiful environment tied to the issue's theme. So make sure to visit 6-Bit Storybooks at 6bitstorybooks.com to subscribe to this stunning new publication and experience the newest issue, Dwell, and follow along on Instagram at 6.bits.storybooks. Max Bainbridge and Abigail Booth have built a life and business together in East London. Max is a woodworker and Abigail is a natural dyer and quilter. And despite their individual practices seeming very different, their roots in traditional craft and the natural environment make them a perfect combo. It's been a pleasure to follow their journey this past year as they've built their business and explored the different facets of making. You can find them at forest-and-found.com and on Instagram at forestandfound. And with that, here's Max and Abigail.
We both went to Chelsea School of Art in London. So that's where we met. And in our last year, we shared a studio together.
Yeah, so we both did fine art at Chelsea. Degree. So we did a fine art degree at Chelsea. And yeah, we shared a studio in our third year.
So it was only then that we kind of realised that A, we were both making a lot, so we were always in the workshops and always dragging bits of materials in and kind of basically always making, which kind of set us a little bit apart from maybe some of the other students on our course.
And she would make me carry all of her heavy things as well.
We graduated and spent probably a year thinking, well, we want to do something which can continue our making process. We left kind of under an atmosphere of not really knowing what we wanted to do, how we wanted to carry on.
And I think we were both kind of so heavily involved in kind of like the making process of our practice, and the kind of art scene at that time was kind of going in a slightly different direction. It just felt a little bit kind of, I don't know, it just felt a bit strange and a little bit kind of like it was going in a direction that we were not.
I think it was more that it was a shock once we left where we were, where you had access to these great workshops and to a studio space. It was kind of like we then knew we wanted to carry on.
Oh yeah, I think we wanted to. You get so used to kind of being in this amazing environment at college, kind of having these amazing facilities. You're kind of it's like that's your full-time job, is being in and making work and kind of your studio practice. And then when you graduate and you leave and you kind of, you don't then have those facilities, and you sort of, you think, right, well, what do? We need to set up a studio, or we need to build a studio, or, you know, what do we do? Do we kind of go and get jobs to fund our practice, or do we, you know, it was a kind of,
yeah,
it was a lot of decisions that we had to make
kind before of, we even got around to making anything.
And
knowing what we wanted to make.
Yeah.
So we kind of, the starting point, I guess, for our business was building our studio, which we built from scratch in our back garden, because you're kind of limited in London with space, and also a lot of studios are so, the rent is so high, it costs so much in order to actually fund having a studio in the first place. It was quite important that we had our own space, something that wasn't going to be a financial burden, so we built our own.
Yeah, for the cost of a couple of months rent on a studio space, we could build our own in our back garden and have something of a kind of equivalent size that we then had permanently, and we could sort of start to furnish it and put things in that we actually needed to start making. And I had a lot of birch plywood left over from my degree show, and we kind of designed a few bits of furniture and made some things and sold some things and kind of did some sort of furniture restoration. But it was became quite clear that that wasn't what we kind of weren't interested in that enough to make it a kind of
full-time pursuit.
And it was sort of neither of us really knew that much about it, and it was kind of, the things you ended up with were really beautiful, but it was sort of like doesn't have the same feeling of what we were kind of getting up for when we were at college. So I guess we kind of just sort of had to sort of step back a little bit and assess what we were actually doing and where we wanted to go with it.
Yes, there was a point at which we had to really sit back and think, you know, what do we want to do? What do we want to wake up and be doing every day? Because we're both the kind of people that need that element of drive behind what we're doing to get up. We need to be doing what we love.
And I think we're both the kind of people that it's like we find it difficult to kind of like find the right kind of holiday to go on, because we're both definitely not the kind of people that can sit by a pool and just kind of like do nothing for a couple of weeks. So it's kind of, unless we're doing like physically making or doing something, it's kind of, it's really difficult to sort of just,
we're not very good at switching off.
No. And I think it was sort of,
yeah, we needed something that was going to occupy us full time, all the time. So I guess initially we started looking at the woodwork element of what we do, because we'd both done a lot of sculpture while at college, and we'd both worked with wood before, so that was just kind of common ground. And you especially, Max, had been
I've always kind of made things and worked with wood and done things. And then at college I made a lot of big structures and spent pretty much my entire third year in the wood workshops, so I was kind of,
yeah, it was like familiar territory, I guess. And I think we were also, I think what we were trying to say initially, that was lacking when we left college was almost like an integrity to materials that we were using, or that there'd definitely been a sense in the art scene that there was a move away from making, and that was always what was very important to us individually and together. Was this physical working with your hands and knowing your materials and knowing where they come from, and the work being very much about the materials and their very nature.
Yeah, and that making process, it was kind of like that had been such an important part of our practice throughout our degree. It was kind of, it was difficult to then kind of
have a period where that wasn't, we weren't able to, just because we didn't have the space. So it was like the space had to come first in order for us to figure out then what we were going to do.
And I think it which was made kind of, you know, which it was kind of harder in a way because of how the kind of art world or art scene was kind of, how it felt to us that it was moving away from this kind of sort of very hands-on kind of physical making process. And it was kind of like that had been our practice and our kind of world, but then when you kind of are out of the kind of educational side of things, you're sort of on the outside looking in a bit, and it was kind of, where do we then, you know, how
do
you
take this?
Yeah, and how do you make that? Yeah, how do you fit in? And it was kind of, I guess that was quite daunting. But
yeah, and then so we'd kind of looked at woodwork, and we're looking at traditional ways of working, and then looking at the craft world, which we'd never been a part of. And so we had kind of looked at carving and wood turning, and we bought a lathe, and Max had started learning how to work this way. And I kind of felt like I knew my skills weren't in chisels and wood turning per se. I could design and work, and, you know, I am very much part of the design of it, but I knew physically that wasn't going to be what I was doing. So where we live in London, in Walthamstow, there's a huge kind of, I guess, a textile industry here. I think it's quite traditional. There's lots of fabric shops on the high street. So we were kind of surrounded by fabric. Every day we go out the house, you walk down, and there's just, you know, fabric shops everywhere with these amazing fabrics in. So I just kind of thought, I'd been used to working with found objects, and whatever materials I'd had to hand, that was what I used to use in my fine art practice. So I thought, you know, this resource is here, and there must be something I can do with it. So I started looking at textiles, basically, and not coming from a textiles background, again, it was kind of slightly daunting because you're having to learn everything from scratch. But also, it was almost like I wasn't phased, because I approached it like I approached any other, like you'd make a sculpt, you go, right, I need some glass, I need to do a bit of metal work. How do I do that?
There was no restrictions in terms of your kind, you know, you weren't formally trained in any one area. So it was kind of, you didn't gravitate towards something which would then, you know, you kind of approached it that it was sort of like, right, I just want to explore it.
And yeah, which I still think is quite important, not necessarily having been trained in textiles, that I don't know the limits of it, I guess. And I think that it was as soon as I'd started working and particularly looking at quilts and figuring out how to quilt and making my first few quilts, I was like, I don't know how to get the colours I want. That was like a massive part of it. Was because my work had always been about colour, and it had always been very kind of subtle, sort of considered colour work. So I guess I then started thinking, well, how can I get colour into fabric? Or, you know, I can't find the colours I want to, I can't just buy the colours I want. You know, how else do you get colour? And that's when I kind of discovered natural dyes, and we started looking and researching into natural dyes, and they were the perfect kind of palette for what we wanted to do.
That's really great. Thanks for sharing all that. I wanted to go back a little bit. You know, were both of you guys makers as children? Did you guys come from crafty or maker families?
Yeah.
Yeah. well, you say more than me, but yeah, both of us, yeah.
So my dad's a sculptor, an artist, and my mum is an artist as well. She's a painter, and she is the head of art at the school I went to. And my brother did painting at Chelsea before I went there.
So you go way back.
So I kind of didn't have a choice in any of this. My path was already kind of predetermined for me. But yeah, I've always kind of made stuff, and right from we every summer holiday was spent in our house in France, and it's just in the middle of nowhere, and so you kind of had to find stuff to fill your time. So there was lots of kind of bows and arrows and swords and camps and things made. And then, yeah, so that kind of interest in making and that, you know, kind of whittling for the sake of whittling and kind of carving has always been something that's just been, been a part of my life. But then, so yeah, I have always kind of made stuff.
I'm the same. I've always made, I drew and I painted a lot, and I drew a hell of a lot as a child. And my father wasn't ever particularly arty in any way, but my mum always was. She was always very creative, but her parents were had told us she couldn't go to art school, she couldn't study art because you wouldn't get a job. It was they were quite traditional in that way. So there was a definite emphasis from my mum specifically when we were growing up that me and my brother were going to do whatever we wanted to do. She and my dad would support us in it because she'd never got that opportunity and had always regretted it. So it was always very important to her and to my father that we both went and did what we wanted to do. So yeah, I felt like I've had to fight to prove myself to the rest of the world, but I've always known my parents, my family have got my back.
Well, I think we've both been very lucky.
Makes a massive difference.
Huge difference, yeah, because you're kind of, you know.
Because it's one thing to have to prove yourself to an industry, but it's another to have to prove yourself to your family, I think. I think that's almost scarier.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
In a way.
So, you know, you shared a little bit about your process of building your business and how the studio space needed to come first and you know, utilizing your garden to do that. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your studio and just kind of the process of building it and what kind of your thought process was going into that.
Well, I guess an existing structure was there, which was essentially a garden shed that Max had built while he was at university, because you only get a small studio space while you're there.
Yeah, so it was I think it was maybe at the end of my first year, beginning of my second year, I'd kind of got kind of quite a small studio space, and I was working on some pretty big stuff, and I, you know, you could, the wood workshops were great, but you can't really leave things in there, so you had to kind of bring everything back to your space. So I basically needed somewhere that I could kind of work on things and just leave them and kind of let things kind of develop and ideas kind of, you know, just kind of mull them over and that kind of stuff. So I basically built a 10 foot by 12 foot garden shed really, at the bottom of the garden, which kind of served as a kind of workshop and a bit of a kind of man cave as well, because it had like a TV and stuff in.
And then I came along and that quickly was exited.
We don't need a television in here anymore,
Max. No,
there's no need for surround sound.
It became quite obvious that we needed a much bigger space if we were going to do anything seriously and actually run a business from here. So we had absolutely no money, so we kind of scavenged anything and everything we could. We recycled other sheds and kind of built this extension and kind of boosted the roof. And yeah, it became a bit of a shanty town. Whatever materials we could find, they found their way in there somehow. And we actually have ended up with a really decent sized space, which we are currently extending.
Again.
So it's
going to kind of it's no longer kind of garden shed shaped. It's kind of more sort of
it's a big horseshoe shape. So it's a big U with, and it's really lovely. It has a tree that's kind of in the middle of the U that we don't have permission to chop down.
No.
So that stayed, but it's really beautiful. So there are as many windows as we can fit in that all look out onto the garden, which is a really floriferous, full garden, like mature garden. So that's quite important, I think. Mm. Being in London, you need that sense of escape, and it's certainly a sense of escape.
Yeah, no, it's really nice.
But this new bit's quite important, because in my small textiles room, I've kind of outgrown it now. Things are getting bigger, and
it's probably the sort of 8 sewing machines you have in there as well. Probably doesn't help with the space.
So that's going to make a massive difference, because it'll be a brand new textiles studio, and Max can then take over my old bit for the lathe, so that all, because we have a bit of a problem keeping dust separate.
I don't have a problem with it, but Abigail doesn't.
It's going to become a better functioning space, and then there'll be a deck outside that should hopefully be a natural dyeing deck, so that we've got a more of like, it functions more as an inside outside space.
And it's going to have two entrances, and kind of, so basically now it's kind of, it's gone through its stages of evolution really, and it's kind of ending up somewhere that it's kind of,
it'll be the best it can be.
Yeah, and it's kind of, it's got purpose-built areas for
everything we need. Yeah, how we need it to function, it will function. Otherwise the dyeing and that everything kind of became a bit of, I just was ousted into the garden, even in winter. So now it's going to be I can kind of just flow in between the actual studio and the outside into the garden a bit better.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know what that's like. Last winter, I was naturally dying in the snow, and it was charming because it was my first time doing it at the ranch here. But after that, I was like, you know what? I think this might be the last time.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I've been out there in thunderstorms, and it's miserable. But when you're on order due, there's a deadline. There's like natural dying waits for no man sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine. I usually just kind of watch her out of the window, sitting next to the nice wood and kind of toast warm and dry. And she's kind of like hunched over a bucket and a raincoat. And I just kind of think, oh, I'm glad I don't do that.
At some points, I just think, I can't get any wetter. I'm trying to rinse this fabric and I'm wet from doing that anyway. So the rain doesn't really make a difference at this stage.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about both of your guys' specific crafts that you do as a part of your business.
So I would say I'm a wood carver and turner. So I would say 50% of both, and they're both really lovely crafts, and they have kind of very different qualities. And I think I enjoy the actual kind of physicality and act of wood turning more than carving, but then maybe I think the kind of end result of like the cut, like your the kind of hand carved product, I think maybe sometimes I don't know, maybe I prefer that. It changes pretty much every day. It depends what I'm working on. Sometimes I really hate it, and if a bowl or something has exploded on the lathe because I've made the wall too thin, then I think, oh, I'm just not doing this anymore. It's just terrifying. And then, you know, you go back to it a couple of days later, and it's just a really, really, really kind of lovely sort of meditative process. I guess I've taken sort of like traditional woodworking techniques, so a lot of kind of green woodworking and carving techniques, and kind of using them in sort of more contemporary designs and sort of making utensils and vessels and bowls that are kind of influenced by sort of a lot of traditional ancient designs, but also very contemporary stuff. So I don't just kind of stick to a very specific way of creating something. I use every tool and piece of machinery that I've got in the studio. And some of it is probably a bit unconventional, but it gets us to the final product, and all of those kind of steps are really important. So I think it's kind of a blend and a kind of bit of a mishmash of different ways of working. But I think that's what kind of makes what we do maybe slightly different to kind of other things out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we're avid cooks. We kind of we're homebodies as well, aren't we? So I think a lot of what we, when we're designing products, if we're, you know, making a spoon or a bowl or a quilt or any form of textiles, it's always been about how would we use it? How do we imagine other people would use these? Because it's not making for the sake of making. It's very much about producing objects that will last forever and that people will treasure.
And they have to be functional. You know, they have to really work. And I think that's what's really nice, is because we both really love cooking and food. And it's kind of to be able to sort of troubleshoot something and say, God, it would be great if we had, you know,
a utensil that did this action.
Able to then kind of go down the garden and say, right, well, let's kind of prototype that. Let's have a go at making that. Or, you know, that you. So just things like that, I think, is really important and has a massive impact on products we make, because it was kind of, I think we sort of, the first things we made, it was sort of like, right, I guess we should test that these actually work. You know, that you can eat with them, and that you can roll things out with them, and that you can tenderize things, and that bowl will actually hold fruit or salad or, you know, a breakfast cereal. And I think it was quite kind of it was amazing that these things actually did work, and they were really nice to use, and you know, and then kind of going forward and other people wanting them, and kind of, I think that's been a really nice kind of part as well, is that people genuinely want them to use as well.
Yeah.
So Abigail, I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you got into natural dyeing, like how you picked kind of that as the part of the business to grow, and then the quilting aspect of your business.
So with natural dyeing, it was definitely about not being able to find the right colour of fabric. Because I think I'd painted in the past and I've always been interested in colour in my work. So that ability to be able to almost like mix colour, you kind of lost, I thought, when trying to pick fabric for, you know, to make, if I had a design in mind and I was trying to imagine the colour I wanted, I just couldn't find it. So I'd done some research and stumbled across natural dyeing almost by accident, because I didn't really know that it even existed, which sounds silly now, because now I know a hell of a lot more about it, and I've done a lot of research and I'm so heavily involved in it, I can't imagine not knowing that it existed. I just kind of went hell for leather. Now, once I discovered that you could dye with plants, it was like, right, what can I pick?
Nothing in the garden was safe.
Yeah, and because we were always going out into the forest to collect wood, and we just, like, you know, going on walks in the forest, so we were always in an environment to start like foraging for dye stuff. So I started basically experimenting with anything and everything. And from someone that didn't know a lot about plants, you very, very quickly become almost like you get an eye for dye plants. That sounds a bit strange, but you tune your eye. So even if you've never dyed with it before, you might spot a plant that looks like a bit similar to something that you've dyed with before, and you knew you got a good result. So I started looking at things that way, thinking, oh, I think I might be able to dye with this. I'm not even sure what it is, but I feel like it could have dye in it. So it was a very playful kind of experiment, you know, a lot of experimenting to begin with. And then I started to actually properly understand natural dyeing itself and had a bit more control over it, I guess. Because initially you're just hoping that you're going to get something. You don't necessarily know if you are. But now I definitely feel like I'm in control of it. It's not like this.
But I guess that element of kind of surprise and excitement is still there every single time.
Yeah, that's still there.
Even it's... with things that you kind of, you know you can get pretty kind of, regular-ish
accurate,
kind of results.
Regular
it's results. Sort of, it completely depends.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. The dyeing itself depends on so much. It depends on the water. In London here, we have such hard water. So I have to be aware of that, because that can affect the dye vats. And so I am aware very much of now a lot more. I know what I'm doing. I feel a lot more confident that I understand it a lot. But you're always learning with it.
And I guess also the kind of the sort of our kind of business ethos and how we kind of want to work and to be kind of sustainable as well. That's kind of...
Yeah, that was a massive part of choosing to naturally dye as well. You're working with, you know, I only currently use cotton. I'm just starting to look at dyeing yarn as well. So it's like, there's no point, you know, if you've got such beautiful natural materials to begin with, it was very important that you then treated them with the respect they deserved. So natural dyeing has that sense of sensitivity. And I think I respect colour in that same way. Colour is such a subtle, quiet sort of aspect of the work that we make. It's so considered, and in my head, it's, you know, the slightest balance can tip it. So natural dyeing has that gentle approach, I think. It's the only medium I can imagine now working in to achieve the color, those colors that I want.
And it was nice as well that, you know, we, in terms of kind of going and sort of gathering wood and things for my practice, it was kind of working with forestry commissions and getting things that was kind of would have just been managed, like forest management and things that were just either going to be kind of sent away for firewood or stuff that was just going to be left to kind of rot, that we could kind of start to build up relationships with people where we could actually get this kind of, you know, get that material, and working with cabinet makers to kind of get their sort of like offcuts and waste that would otherwise go to landfill or be burnt. It was kind of, they both started to go kind of hand in hand, and also kind of my kind of waste product of all the kind of chippings and sawdust, a lot of that Abigail has been able to use.
Yeah, so I soak all of the chippings that Max gets from all the different kinds of woods, and then they become dyes in and of themselves. So it's this nice sense of, you know, we're, nothing really ever leaves the workshop, and other than products.
Yeah, I mean, nothing. I mean, as much as we possibly can, nothing is wasted, and I think that's been a really important part of the business, and kind of to try, you know, to sort of, if there wasn't kind of, you know, if we didn't know somebody that was a cabinet maker and that was just getting rid of all this walnut, then we wouldn't make things out of walnut, because it kind of goes against what we're about to then just go and buy kind of exotic hardwoods so it's a really nice kind of way of working, because it also kind of, it makes you kind of work in different ways, and it gives you a massive variety of things. So sometimes, you know, you might come across things that you've never worked with before, and you might not be able to get again, but you can actually kind of make a really fantastic set of something like bowls or utensils or, and
yeah, so could... I think that's a lovely part of that way of working, isn't it? It's the surprise. So a bit of wood might surprise you when we cut into it, or you know, a forage piece of, you know, a forage plant might produce the most unexpected colour. And I think we're gatherers as well, aren't we? We don't necessarily use everything as soon as it comes into the workshop. It might hang around for up to 6 months, and then you might.
We're quite a big believer in just having things around. You know, it's kind of like we'll stop and think, oh, well, that I'm not entirely sure
what that could be used for, but we quite like.
Yeah, or sometimes what that is, but it could have a use. And sometimes it hangs around and doesn't do anything for quite a long time. And sometimes it's put to use straight away, and it can kind of, a shape or a colour can give you an idea for something else. So
yeah, I mean, the fact, you know, I build up this stock of fabric and with this lovely palette of colours that then just sit there, and I think about them, and some of them I haven't used. They've been around for maybe a year, but eventually they'll end up in something. But it's when that colour will be needed. It's when it will be just that perfect shade. Yeah.
So what is the process that you use to make your quilts?
So I guess the designs often come from the colours. So I think it's definitely that way around, as opposed to having something in my head and thinking, right, this needs to be made. I kind of sit on the colours a lot, and then I'm thinking, right, that this, an idea will come to mind, or a design will come to mind. So I tend to design things first on paper, and use watercolors as well to try and sort of look at how the colors are going to work together. And then I set about, either if there's a color that's missing, I'll try and achieve it. So sometimes dyeing will go on for weeks before any fabric even gets cut. So all my quilts are machine pieced on my sewing machine, and then I'll layer the quilt top with cotton batting and a back piece that tends to be pieced from scraps. And then they're all marked up and hand quilted, which is the long bit, but it's also the most relaxing. Because after all that work goes into it, all the dyeing and everything, sometimes it can be fraught as well. The patchwork itself can be tricky, because you have to be so accurate, and you have to concentrate so hard the whole way through. But once you get to the quilting, it's like, right, I can sit back and quilt for at least 3 days, if not a week, depending on the size of the quilt, which is very meditative. It's a lovely process. And then they're all bound, and yeah, the binding is sewn on first by the machine, and then I finish it by hand on the back. So they take quite a long time.
They're beautiful. So how did you get into quilting?
So probably about 2 years ago now, Max bought me a small book from a charity shop on patchwork and quilting. And I'd never really, I don't think I'd ever consciously thought about it, because in America, obviously, quilting's a massive thing. And in England, it is too, but it's definitely not as much a part of the national identity, I don't think. So I hadn't really been aware of it as such. A lot of my research while I was at doing my degree had been in into America and American landscape, and I've always had this fascination with America, and I spent 6 months in my second year in San Francisco studying there. So I think I then was very drawn, when I got this little book on quilting and patchwork, I was very, very drawn to the Amish quilts, and to that kind of clean simplicity of them, and their colours as well. So I just sort of started thinking, I think this might be something that I want to do and I want to pursue. So I just started playing around, seeing whether I could piece things together using sort of these basic quilt designs from this tiny little book. And then we went to France for quite a long period, about 3.5 weeks, and we had an old Singer sewing machine there. And I just took some fabric and for these 3 weeks just kind of sewed and sewed and sewed, and came back with these two quilt tops. And that was kind of the first proper patchwork and quilting that I'd done.
I guess that was where we both, because I took
you
I
took your lathe
I took
well.
The lathe with us as well.
So and, it's lovely there. There's no internet whatsoever. So for 3 weeks, you have to kind of occupy yourself. And it's lovely. It's the perfect getaway from technology.
So that's our kind of holiday, is kind of machinery and no kind of contact with the outside world. And we both basically, because that was the first, you know, we basically just intensively for 3.5 weeks learned our kind of craft, really, didn't we?
Yeah, and I think it always seems kind of slightly amateur that you've taught yourself, or that you kind of didn't know something, and people have, you know, some people have been woodworking for years, and we've only been sort of working with textiles and wood for the past probably 2 years.
Coming up to two years.
Yeah, but I think because of our background, that's just how we made work. We always adopted new techniques and new ways of working, so it never felt strange, or it never felt like we were amateurs at it, because I think we were so that way inclined.
It was just another
way of making work, I guess.
Yeah, because it was kind of, you had to kind of problem solve quite a lot, and if you were making something you'd never made before when we were at college, it was sort of you just had to kind of find a way to do it and work a way around it. And it was sort of, well, if this is what we both want to do and we both want to kind of learn these kind of skills
crafts,
then we just have to kind of
just
set
get
about,
on and do it.
Yeah, teaching ourselves and kind of, you know, looking at books and using YouTube and...
Yeah, I think that's what's so amazing now, is that it's if you need to know how to do something, you can just YouTube it, and there are the most amazing people out there who've got the most amazing videos of how to do these very specific techniques. So I learned a lot with quilting that way. It was like, I was like, oh, how do you bind a quilt? And I thought, oh, I'll check YouTube. And there's a lovely American lady who was just showing you step by step. And it was like, well, that has never failed me, that method. It's brilliant. We learned a lot that way. And then you learn yourself. And when you come up against problems, you just solve them.
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's so much of, like, when I first got started in design and tech, and then, you know, craft. That's, I mean, obviously it's our generation that has really had that to learn from the most. And but it's funny, because now that I'm up here in Idaho, I meet so many people that are much older than me that are kind of like mentors in certain spaces, and it's such a reversal from like what I'm used to of just going online. And so it's pretty interesting just to have those two different paradigms merging together. And I imagine, you know, you had mentioned in London or in the UK that, you know, quilting is, it's different, I guess, than here in the US. And I guess less specifically about quilting, but more just about your guys' maker community. What is it like over there in the UK?
I think, well, the best way we can describe it, I think, when we're talking to people, is that it feels like in America that craft has been this...
It's never gone away.
It's never gone away. And in the UK, it definitely feels like it's going through a revival. Like it went away and now it's in this huge... It's having a huge comeback. So there's, I think that's how we get the impression that's what it feels like.
No, I mean, it's kind of, I think it's...
So it's exciting to be part of it at the moment because there is this sort of huge sense of revival and the government's put quite a lot of money into, you know, different organisations are there available for kind of grants and funding. So it doesn't feel like you're trying to strike out on an unknown path.
I think the kind of the general public as well are kind of...
are very much behind it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interest in it, and it's kind of... I think for quite a long time there's been, especially with our kind of... with our respective crafts, there's almost been sort of like stigmas attached to them, that it's kind of, you know, that they're not necessarily the kind of coolest things to do, and, you know, a very sort of specific type of or kind of like age group of people do them. And it's kind of like, I guess in a way that's true, but that, you know, there's such an amazing wealth of knowledge and people that are doing it and that you can learn from and that you come across, that actually it doesn't kind of, you know, it isn't as, you know, isn't that kind of sort of stigmatized sort of, you know, old guy in his shed, or kind of, you know, sort of, it's different now, and I think it's got a really nice feel.
And I think there's very much an emphasis on contemporary craft in London especially. So it's very much, when we're making, it's a lot, we're always thinking, you know, how do our products relate today? You know, we're not trying to... there are people who stick very traditionally to traditional methods of working, in woodwork and quilting, but we're always thinking, you know, what sets it apart? How will people relate to these objects today? And how can we push, you know, these very traditional methods of working to make very contemporary objects? And how will the public then relate to them? But it's just a really exciting time at the moment, because there's an audience there who are desperate to engage with what we're doing. And it's lovely. You get people who don't have any other access to this very real, I don't know, they it feels very real what we do and what other people around us are doing. It's getting back to very traditional ways of working with materials that had, I think there's a craving for it.
Yeah. I think everything is so tangible. It's kind of like that, you know, through it, if you buy a quilt or a bowl or a kind of, you know, a hand forged sort of kitchen knife or a really beautifully kind of woven basket, it's kind of, you know that it's been made by somebody, and you can feel that and you can see it. And when you use it, that it has a sense of history about it. And whether that history is the sort of like the, you know, 800 years of whatever that particular craft has existed for, but it's kind of a sort of a modern spin on it, or a kind of, you know, that way of working is kind of evident through the object. And I think people love that. And you know, that story behind it, I think, is also something that people really get behind and really want to kind of be able to kind of have a bit of.
And I guess what you were saying earlier about being a generation of technology, when we said that when we came out of college, a lot of people around us were making work very much about the internet and about everyone's sort of absorption in this sort of other dimension. And I think what we've found in the past few years is this real need for people to actually step back from that and feel that there is still this connection to the real, whether it is to, you know, the sheep that yarn come from, or where, or, you know, or the forest where the wood comes from. It's people are so, I think even when they're buying, not just for us as makers, but the public out there who are buying, who are then buying what we're selling, they very much need that sense of connection to the outdoors and to where things come from. Mm. I think that's the kind of crucial.
I think it needs to be real as well. It's kind of like for us to, you know, we for us to be able to kind of make these things and have you actually have to have that relationship with the, you know, with where your materials come from. That you've, I think it makes a massive difference that you've been out and, you know, foraged for dye stuffs, or, you know, you've been and kind of worked with a tree surgeon or a forestry kind of worker and actually sourced these things and then kind of brought them back, and you kind of, you know, their history and you know where they're from. And I think that all has a massive impact on the kind of process and then the finished product and then the kind of, you know, the sort of the story and journey that whoever's buying it then kind of takes on. And I think it has to be real, I think is yeah, what we've found, and I think what our kind of business, I guess, is about, really.
Yeah.
What's in the future for Forest and Faun?
Well, I think we're very excited for this whole Christmas run to kind of be over and for the new year to start. And that sounds dreadful, but it's very much, it's that this whole lead up to Christmas is so about being able to meet our orders, get all the deadlines done, get everything made for the whole Christmas
mania. Abigail wears a Scrooge jumper at Christmas time.
No, not Christmas as a family, not that whole side of Christmas, but the business side of Christmas is quite overwhelming.
Mm. I mean, we've got some really lovely things coming up, and we do. We're doing Renegade, and we're doing some other really
some lovely fairs and kind yeah, of. So not that part of it, but it's, we're, I think, for the new, in our heads for the new year, we've spent so long getting the business on its feet that I think we're so excited to spend some solid time on making and look and kind of working on really thinking about the products we're making and actually having some time to ourselves, because we work on some actually quite small wholesale orders for independent shops, but you get so taken over by the demands on your actual business that we crave the time just to be able to make the things we want to make and actually experiment a bit, so that you're not having to reach that deadline, so you can play around with different dye vats and different sort of, you know, different shapes of spoon, and that time becomes so precious. So I think we want to start releasing sort of small, very thought out collections of products. And we're thinking a lot at the moment about how the woodwork relates to the textiles. So getting a lot more of a, especially for the public to understand slightly more about our working process and how those two elements of the business very much coincide. Because at the moment, I think they come across a bit disparate, but they're not, because of the way we work. But I think we want to start actually curating our shop a bit more, and to actually have the products we make kind of have more of a conversation with each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's very much where our mindset is for this whole next year, is that is going to be a real push to get that element of it
working
properly, and also for our own as designers and makers, that's kind of very much where our head's at the moment, isn't it? Because I think we find that what's in our head takes about a year to to translate through the business. So you have all these ideas, but it takes a very long time for those to actually manifest and get to the point, because you do have to experiment and you do have to be in the studio working on things before that then reaches your audience. And there is this real lag and delay.
Well, I think there's also a balance and a compromise, because it's kind of you have your, you know, you at the beginning you kind of develop things and you work on things that then actually become popular and could, you know, are kind of like your best sellers, or that people, you know, people kind of, it's like your staple kind of products, which is great because you know that you kind of, you can rely on those. And then, but then it's sort of on the, you then have to balance that against, well, I now have to spend X amount of time making those things. And
what I really want to be doing is making these other things that people have never seen before.
So it's kind of, it's all a big balance, but yeah. We've got some really exciting stuff kind of coming.
You have got your first workshop coming up in spoon carving, and I've been teaching patchwork and quilting for the past few months. So I think that's going to become a far larger part of the business, is our outreach in terms of teaching.
And developing workshops that kind of have a bit of a crossover, and that kind of, you know, a sort of, you know, that could possibly be a more of an experience, maybe over a kind
few
of
days, over a couple of days than, and, you know, a few hours.
Yeah.
The winner of last week's giveaway is Erica Garris. You've won a skein of the beautiful Pamiri yarn from Kismet Fiberworks. Congratulations. This week's giveaway is sponsored by Old Homestead Alpacas, and they're giving away a skein of their small farm Surrey alpaca yarn, homegrown in Walla Walla, Washington. To enter this giveaway, leave a comment on today's episode's blog post at woolful.com. The biggest of thanks to everyone involved in this week's episode: Elaine, Melissa, Melody, Abigail, and Max. I hope you'll join me each week as we talk and learn from more fascinating fiber folk. For podcast notes, visit woolful.com. If you're interested in being a part of this podcast, including our Man on the Street or Farmyard Tales segment, or as an episode or giveaway sponsor, shoot me an email at hello@woolful.com. Have a wonderful week.